Bink, the humble monster.
Instead of everybody just be talking, so I got with all my Howard dudes and I was like, yo, we ain't just gonna be talking, we gonna make this thing happen. So we just started an investment group and we've been going over like all the things we're about to move into.
I think you went there the same time my best friend went there.
Who's your man?
Jason Frum, last name Frum.
Oh shit, when he went there?
He went there from like 91 to 95.
Yeah, we was definitely there at the same time. I went 92 to 96.
He was a Q.
Oh, yeah. We definitely ran into each other then.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, they be doing all the parties, so yeah.
I already know you guys know each other, but it's 1 degree of separation on that campus, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Reference. Yeah. I'm going to get the intro out of the way. So before we get into it, let me introduce my guy. The Grammy Award-winning mixer, Wall Street Journal's most famous and successful engineer in hip-hop history. That's crazy. Legendary DJ and producer, Young Guru.
My brother, thank you for having me, man. This is amazing.
Come on, man. I had to get you up here.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
So, shit, let me ask you, who in the house, in your household, was the music influence, your mom or your pops?
Both. It was both of them, man. Like, first of all, I come from that situation of, like, my family was strong in terms of the men.
Period. Right.
So not only just my pops, but my grandfather, you know what I mean? On both sides. All the men is always present. Like, we was hood and we did whatever we had to do, but if you made a baby, you took care of that baby. So the fathers, that's I'm saying that to say that's a weird situation for us as black men, especially during that time.
Yeah.
My father was the father to the whole neighborhood. To the whole neighborhood. So my pop was really into, like, slow jams. He was one of them cool, like, you remember back in the 70s, it wasn't to out gangster somebody, right? It was to out cool, like, a gangster, if he got upset, it made you look weak. My pop was from that breed of the, like, they was the cool niggas.
your pop, 70 in the 70s?
Yeah, absolutely. He was born in 1946.
Yeah. My pop was
48. Yeah. So that was my pop. So everything slow jams, but Parliament Funkadelic was his turn up. Like, anything Parliament Funkadelic, my pop is on the table. That's the only thing. That and James Brown. But James Brown was more of his, you know what I mean? I'm getting my drink on thing. But Parliament Funkadelic was his whole turn up, stand on the table, just get it in. My mom's was the famous black records of that day. So.
Right.
All the Earth, Wind & Fire, all the Marvin Gaye, all the Stevie Wonder, all the, like, you know what I mean? All of that was through my mother. And then gospel, you know what I'm saying? My mom was big on gospel. So that was my musical influence coming up. And then my best friend, who his father and my father went to school together, he was the avid jazz dude. He was the, like, yo, he got all the jazz records that in a normal jazz collection. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So the thing would be to go over to my homie's house. We chilling for a minute. His pop leave. I steal a couple jazz, two or three. You know, take them home, listen to them. But I bring them back and put them.
Right. Absolutely, got to. They meticulous. Those guys are meticulous. They know it's missing.
Right. So that was my influence to answer your question. It was my mom and my pop with the funk, and my dad with the funk, my mom with the current records, but then my homies, his father was in the jazz, and that was sort of my mixture together.
Well, we had similar stories because my father was he wasn't a DJ, but he missed his calling because he got paid on Friday. So after work, two things he did: liquor store, record stuff.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Mine too. Yeah.
He didn't call us, man. Listen, I got the new OJs come through. Yo, I got that new, you know what I'm saying? The Temptations and the Spinners, and like, he was all those guys. And then my mom was the choir director in church. So, you know, she got the James Cleveland going, the Texas Mass Choir, and all that type of stuff.
She was actually a choir director, though.
Yeah, that's how I ended up playing drums in church, because of my mom.
Okay.
My mom recognized me beating on the recliner while she was cleaning up. She had the James Cleveland going, so I got two coat hangers. I'm beating on the chair to the, she like, hold up, this nigga on beat. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not getting it though. So we go to my aunt's house that night. They pull out these drums in the attic, old raggedy pair of drums with the glitter paint job in it. It was orange colored drum. Right. They was raggedy as hell though, right? I still not getting it. Next thing you know, I'm in the front of the church with a bunch of Vaseline on my face and a suede bow tie. Playing drums in church, yo. So that's we had the same type of influence as far as that's concerned, you know what I'm saying, from both sides.
Because you saying that about your mom's being a director. Like, my mom's was in the choir, but I'm sure you got a whole different knowledge from your mother being a choir director and just me thinking of your sound and the influence of knowing what church did to us, you know, like from that perspective.
She trained me first. She trained me first. We got 5 or 6 generations of family that sing.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So we was known around Norfolk, you know what I'm saying? The whole Hampton Roads area is just the Chavis singers. You know what I'm saying? So I was singing in the choir first.
Right.
As a child, you know what I'm saying? So it's a whole bunch of pictures of me with the little short tight fro.
That's ill too for you to say that, like, so many generations is in one particular place, right? So you in Norfolk. So you gotta understand, like, my mother come from Newark, New Jersey.
Right.
My father come from Washington, D.C., Southeast Washington, D.C., right?
Right.
So all of them converge on what's known now as Delaware State, right? In Delaware. Right. And a bunch of them from all these different places then make a community in Wilmington. So they like, oh, okay, all of us went to school together. We're gonna start buying houses together in Wilmington, Delaware.
Right.
So my community was made up of a bunch of people that's from a bunch of different places, from Philly to Atlantic City to New Jersey to DC to, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, but they all converge on Wilmington in the early 70s and be like, we're gonna make our community together. We're gonna take care of each other. Right. You know, my pop's best friend becomes the director of Park and Recreation, which is the very first place where I'm coming out, you know, as a 12-year-old, hooking up to a generator, playing in the middle of the project. You know, like, so all of this is facilitated. I'm just saying it's ill because you talking about it from a generational standpoint of we all was this much in this city, and mine's is from all these cities coming together in this one place and being like, we're just going to hold each other down. You know what I mean? Like, that was the building community, especially with what we're talking about now, right? In our normal thing,
yeah.
Building community. And that's where the hip hop come from of people when they like, Ghoul, you was outside when you was 12, 13. Yeah, I was in the middle of the park. You know what I mean? City Park and Recreation, hooked up to a generator.
That part. Because I started DJing in the 8th grade as well.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, you know, that all that, you know, like you say, blood don't make you family. So you still, even though y'all weren't no kin, that was still a family, what right. y'all had going on. You know what I'm saying? Whereas my family was like literally everybody sing. Like, my son can sing. And it's just weird that, you know what I'm saying? Like, that was the only thing I used to worry about, if all my kids could sing in key. Like, when they be singing songs in the car, my kids be tone deaf, you know what I'm saying? That was my main concern. But as far as DJing, like, shit, we both know it's a huge difference in the DJ game now. Because I know I probably had about 6 crates, the longest.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, these guys have no idea to be able to go to every party with every record they own in your laptop is like, because you can get somewhere and be like, you know what? I didn't bring that crate.
Right.
And
you
be
still
like,
gotta
rock
the party. You still gotta make it so that people are having a good time. But it's like restricted to these crates. And then even to a certain extent, it was just like, yo, the volume of it, right? To even carry that, like to carry 4, 5, 6 different crates of records and your turntables and the lights and the microphone and the amps and the
speakers. All of that. And look, don't forget your siren. Don't forget your siren.
Yeah. It was a different thing, man. It was a different thing.
Man, entirely different. That's why I say people don't understand. Then you got to keep them clean because there ain't nothing worse than a record skipping.
Right.
In the middle of a party. It's like, I used to always blame somebody that was standing close to me. I'd be like, yo, move back, line my ass up, but yo, move back, bro, don't bump the set. A record was dirty, but you know, other than that, what record made you fall in love with the whole culture with hip hop. You know what I'm saying? Because Run DMC did it for me. You know what I'm saying? I bought 30 Days with the first record I bought myself with my drumming money from church. Right. I walked to the joint and bought the vinyl and came back, and I took that record with me everywhere. So what got you?
Man, I think it's, for me, it's before records. It was, so you got to understand, I'm telling you again, that my mother's from New Jersey, my father from D.C. So when my cousins from Jersey was sending me tapes, or like say my cousin Tariq, who's like my immediate family that was up in Jersey that would come down to Delaware and bring tapes of whatever they was doing. It was initially when I was hearing tapes. So it was like what the DJs was doing in the parks. And I can remember me getting into a fight with him because he wouldn't tell me what Down by Law meant. Right? So I'm hearing me and him in the house tussling. Because I'm like, yo, I gotta know what the new slang is, and da, da, da. He wouldn't tell me what it meant. But it was initially tapes. But I would say the first record had to be like Rapper's Delight, and as commercial as that record was, it was the first time that I saw hip hop being played in all these different places. Before then, hip hop was something that we did in the parks. It was like an organized thing. It was like us bringing literally cardboard. We had breakers. We had DJs. It was an organized like.
Absolutely.
Community thing. And we knew everybody that was involved in it. So the first time I heard it on this big commercial level as a kid, I was just like, yo, like they listening to rap records on the radio. That was crazy to me. And then I think what Run DMC did to me was to see it on a worldwide level. To see it as a like, yo, this they playing, you know, this festival and that festival, and now they on MTV when there was the only other black artist on MTV was Michael Jackson. And it was like, that was a whole other world to us. So to
and
see,
don't leave out Herbie Hancock. That was
That
was the only records I waited for all day.
Yeah, to see DST, you know what I'm saying, do what he did on the Herbie Hancock record. We got little spurts of it. So around that time, like DST does that, we get a little bit of break-in. In the movies now, right? So when Flashdance came out and we saw breaking in Flashdance in the movie theater, we like, yo, this is incredible. Like, you know, B-Boy, any aspect of hip hop that was in the mainstream to me was incredible. But record wise, it was just like, I got to start listening to the way that they make these. It was just, it caught me from that bug from the beginning. And then once I found out, cause I used to think this was my thinking, right?
Right.
Listening to Run DMC, I'm like, okay, they making these with beat machines. So I got to figure out, you mean as a technical dude, what beat machine are they using? So then when I started hearing samples in records, I was just like, yo, what beat machine is that that does that? And it was like, nah, it comes from this record.
The break.
Like, yo, how do they do that? I had no idea sampling. I had no idea of, you know what I mean? I'm thinking a beat machine with a kick, snare, and a hi-hat, and Run DMC just rhyming over that. So that, I think that era in and of itself, all the records that came out with cover bands trying to replay records and then certain people sampling records, that's what caught me in hip hop. But I'm saying the whole thing of it.
Yeah.
I was the guy that had, my next door neighbor was the illest graffiti writer, right? My man Kenny.
Right.
And he used to get paid to do like little t-shirts at the Italian festival. You know, he's the dude that got the stand set up and you come and you sit down and he look at you and he doing this and paint your face on the t-shirt, right? That was his hustle. So he was the ill graffiti writer.
Right.
And it was like seeing movies that reflected that life. And I was, you know, like the same way that the DJ in Beat Street is Ramo's filling guy, right? That's his man. And Ramo's a graffiti artist, but he's taking his man along with him and he's filling in that was me and Kenny. I was the DJ, he was the graffiti artist. I used to just go along with him and fill in. He'd draw it in yellow and then fill his part in red, fill his part in green, and then he'd come back and trace it in black. And I was doing everything about hip hop is what brought me into the culture. You know what I mean? So it wasn't just one record, it was the whole culture of b-boying, graffiti, emceeing, and then that part of it that was like my thing. I was already the engineer. I was already the guy that like, if your bike gets messed up, I'm gonna fix your bike. I'm gonna do it. We're not charging people for it, just I knew how to do it.
Right.
So then,
crazy.
Now that technical part come in to where the older cats is looking at me like, yo, like, he know how to do crossovers, and he know how to hook up the speaker system, and he know how to do, at 13, I was like, yeah, like, this is what I do. So that's what brought me, being behind the rope at 13 years old, I don't know if I can convey that to the young kids of what that.
That was huge. That was huge. Power. Yeah. That was huge. He was that dude. You know what I'm saying? But to go back to your Run DMC thing is, I got the blessing to get the session to Peter Piper. Mm. Right? No, I'll send that to you.
I need that.
He scratched Nautilus live the whole time.
The whole time.
It's not loop. He literally blended that shit in the entire time, bro.
Whole time.
Killed me. But what kept the continuity to it was the 808 drums.
Right.
That they programmed in there. So that's what kept, that was the glue. That was the A. You know what I mean? That's what kept everything together. But he literally blended in that Nautilus drum the entire record. I was like, yo, who would have thought?
Not to skip forward, and we'll get to this point eventually, right?
Yeah.
But that's what bugged me out about when Rick Rubin did 99 Problems. It's not programmed. He literally is scratching Big Beat down the whole time and then, like, editing it. But the original thing, he'll, like, scratch the drum track and then scratch he was scratching that record to the way we used to do it back then.
He's from that era.
Yeah, he's from that era. And that's why I said it related to me when you just said that. I was like, yo, watch Rick Rubin produce 99 Problems like that was just ill.
I've never met him. That's somebody I most definitely got to meet. You know what I'm saying? Because fucking Beastie Boys and all the rent, like all that stuff was just like, wow. You know what I mean? The LL stuff. Like, it's just
I mean to fast forward us, but we was in that era of, we was in that era of like, that's how we constructed records. And for me, to be honest with you, I'm in Delaware, right? So I'm watching a bunch of people do it. I'm watching Cash Money and Marvelous. I'm watching, Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince. I'm watching, like just all of the Philly combination where it had to be this ill DJ with a good MC.
Right.
And I would study the way that Jazzy Jeff made his records. And a lot of that is the drum loop coming from a beat machine, but then scratching in all the samples six minutes down. Then you rewind the tape, and then you add the other parts, and then you rewind the tape, and then you add the other, then you do the rhyme.
That part. Because my thing is, I tell people all the time, you can't teach feel.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? So people think you have to be meticulous, everything has to be on the one. It's like, no. That's the last thing you want to do, is try to put everything precise. So that's why shit being a little loose with just mixing it in, like, you're not going to catch that. Why you right now it's just way off. But as long as it's
just on production, and that's a natural thing, right? Because if you're listening to the record as somebody that is a 13, 14-year-old kid and is just listening to records, you start thinking on the one. You know what I mean? You start learning music, you read, you know what I mean? You go on to different. So I'm gonna tell you, my thinking of making records wasn't thrown off from that concept until I got with D-Dot. To where it was like, yo, the sample don't start on the one. He starts on the snare before the one, and just like the loop comes from I never looped a record that didn't start on the one until I got with D-Dot. To where he started hitting the loop comes from the snare before the one. It's the and then the
right.
And I was like, what? Just that concept, the way you listen to records to be like, nah, I could loop it. Because before that, and almost before you, I was thinking from the standpoint of like starting on the one and also chopping around vocals.
Right.
If the person started singing, that's not the part I'm going to use. I'm going to use the music part. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So then it's like getting with different producers and engineering for them. I was like, oh, shit, the loop starts on the snare. Big made this beat where he includes the singing part. And I'm just like, oh shit. Like I will always chop around once if you listening to just straight vinyl, no beat, no tempo, no nothing, you like, where's the music part at? Whereas you would bring in like, no, the little vocal thing is part of what I'm doing. And I was like, oh, this shit is a whole different.
So that's basically what All I Need was in Mama Loves Me. because Mama Loves Me was built around the ooh, the Al Green oohs, but everything else was the music. And right. All I Need was built on the Natalie Cole, the three notes, da, da, da.
Right.
The whole beat was built around that. So, yeah, it just made it work for me. You know what I'm saying? That type of thing.
Yeah, but you can understand how that's so innovative to somebody who's like, when you just deciphering records without knowing how to because again, back then, there was no internet. There was no, you know, this is, let me do the demo YouTube video of how this person made the beat. And the, you might even know what the record was. You just like, to even count where the one is at. You know what I'm saying?
Like, so, I remember trying to figure out from the Streets Is Watching soundtrack, that Kool & the Gang's loop. It was like five bars or set. It was some off. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, you had to do that freehand. There's no way
right.
you can loop this.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So, but that's all feel.
Right. Right.
So somebody who's going to be going with X's and O's, they're going to run away from that. They can't get it to on that one. You know what I mean? Yeah. So they're going to just run away from it. So whereas you just, man, just loop it how we feel it and just, like, ain't no nigga. The same way J-Dum did that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? All the way down. The whole
all
time.
All the way down.
Not even programmed. It was just a continuous hitting of the with the sample.
Get her done.
Yeah.
But I didn't know you started with Nonchalant.
Yeah, no. So monumental in my career, Bank. Like, so.
I'm gonna give you
this for your podcast. It's like, people always talk about, hey, I started with Nonchalant and I was the DJ for her. We went on the Fuji tour in 1996. And no, listen. I'm in my senior year at Howard. I have a job at this point. So I'm literally working at the Marriott, but I'm also doing parties. I'm a well-known DJ. But for me, it was just about, yo, I gotta constantly have money coming into my pocket.
Right.
So I've worked since I was 12 years old. If that's a paper route, if that's being a lifeguard, if that's working, no matter, I got a job. Working is a fun thing for me. So I don't think like, yo, you know what I mean? Let's be clear, all that, like, everything I did as a hustle was always a legal hustle. Because I had the other aspect of it so close to me. So I was like,
yo, DJ money was a bonus.
No. It was a complete, because I'm looking at street aspect.
Yeah.
It's literally right next to me. And I'm like, nah. And it's a point about the old OGs where those that was really in it kept their family away from it. So I had cousins, I had uncles, I had, you know, that was like, nah, don't do this. Go this route. You the basketball playing, music making one of us.
Right.
So they kept me away from that. But I'm saying it to say, when I've always worked. So in 1996, I had my first, you know, my first child. And Nonchalant saved my life. She saved my life because she basically came to the crib. I was living on 6th in Florida with Tracy Lee. Right, Tracy Lee, who had, you know, his Party Time and all that. He was still at Howard, right? His Party Time didn't come until 97. So in 1996, she comes to the crib like, yo, I need a DJ, but I need him to be local because she didn't want to pay for a New York motherfucker to be coming down and flights and, you know what I mean? She was like, I need a DC-based DJ. So she comes, I audition for right in the hood. I give it to her. She came to 6th in Florida, bro. Like
that part.
Yeah, that part. And did a routine for, and that Friday, we did a show opening up for the Fugees in Miami. Right? So 5 o'clock is bumping right now. She's like, yo, I did this 5 o'clock record, it's moving. She signed directly to MCA, right? Major deal. We do this opening act, and that night, it was just such a great vibe between all of our camps, between me, Non, our whole camp, and the Fugees. They, like, really, not to use a play on words, they really nonchalantly was like, hey, y'all want to open up for us on the European part of our tour?
Is that a trick question?
Yeah.
Like, absolutely we do.
What? So we was like, yeah. So I'm now calling my parents. I'm just like, yo, I'm not finishing school. The thing I've been training for is in my lap right now.
Right.
And I got to go take it. So for 3 months, Nonchalant was the opening act for the Ready or Not tour in Europe. So this is my first time needing a passport. This is my first time seeing a major tour. And I'm talking about a major tour to where I'm so used to the hip hop version of what we got to go through at this point. When we walk into a club, the sound man ain't really fucking with us. You know, you battling with him all night. No, I'm walking into a tour where it's EQs that got my name on it. And they like, "Goo, sound check your mic," and boom, 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 boom. And they get the EQ right and they save that preset. And it's like, they really care. And I'm just like, whoa, this is different.
This is the life. I can get used to this. I can get used to this.
And I'm getting paid for this. And I'm just like, I saved all that money, right? And Nonchalant was the main person that was just like, "Yo, I got these two songs. I got 5 o'clock in the morning. I got Until the Day." We stretched that out into a 4-hour show based off them two records.
Wow.
That's a lot of me bringing up whatever the latest instrumental is. That's a lot of me studying and going, "Yo, I'm in this country and this is the ill record right now. Let me grab this instrumental and let her rhyme off of that." And the crowd's going to go crazy over this and that. That's where my learning process came of serving the crowd.
Right. I mean, not to mention the Fugees were geniuses at that. Genius.
Incredible. Not only do I get to do this, I get to watch them every night on this professional level.
That part.
They're doing things like, one night our bus got into an accident. Lauren, Clef, and Pry sent they bus for us, booked tickets for their whole crew just so they could send us the bus and be like, "Nah, y'all gonna make it to the next show and we gonna..." They were showing us love like I've never seen before. This is Lauren. This is on off days, me going to the movies with like Miriam, Lauren, my man Mal, and me. Just us four going to the movies. Because we got an off day.
That's nuts.
And we walking past places where the magazines got Lauren on the magazine in the front. You remember when she was the fashion darling at that time because she was killing the, like, you know, the like the army fatigue pants with a like nice little top with the shoes and the, murdering the B-girl style.
Killing with the twists.
So I can say that Nonchalant is really the reason. Without her, I wouldn't be in this. Like that's my big sister, and that's like, she gave me that shot. So the real part of it is, while we in the buses, while we on these vans, my man Matt will always tell you, he'd be like, "Yo, Goo was always reading these books. And I'm reading engineering books."
Right.
As I'm on tour, I'm reading everything about compressors, about EQs. I get every magazine from every city that we stop in that's in English. And I'm just like, "Do you got the English version of Sound on Sound?" And I'm just reading it. And I'm, you know, that, all of that. So we come home, and when Nan starts her second album, I stepped in Nan and I was just like, "Yo, I know how to engineer." She looking at me as her DJ. Imagine your DJ coming to you and be like, "No, I know how to run this whole studio shit." She like, "For real, Ru?" I'm like, no, I'm telling you. I know what I'm doing. So Nonchalant is the first person that ever put me in the hot seat to where you run the session. But imagine the comfort, Bink, of it being, that's your group already. So the nervousness that an engineer would have when he's trying to figure out, like, imagine if I just throw a new nigga in the room with Teddy Riley. You're going to be nervous as fuck. You happy you got the chance, but it's just like, you nervous because you don't want to mess up. My nervousness was with my own group. So it's like, we doing the beats. And the killer thing is that Chucky Thompson was the executive producer of her second album.
OG, shout out to Chucky.
Now you put me in a seat where Chucky gets to see me work because of Nine. And we working on that album. So Chucky naturally goes, "Yo, Goo, I ain't never met nobody like you. If I can give you the knowledge of what these other people in New York got, they could never have the thing that you got because you grew up in this."
Right.
So Chucky was the one that was like, "Yo, I got to go do this Bad Boy mix and Tony Maserati is mixing it. I'm gonna make sure that the company pays for you to fly with me from DC to New York, and I want you to sit in the room with Tony Maserati and learn everything he knows."
Hands on is always the best, bro.
That's why I'm saying the tree come from Nam.
Right.
It come from her. So that's what got me with Chuck, which was got me to New York to see what was going on with all the Bad Boy set. I was always up there with Chuck. So imagine me walking in there with Chucky, and then it's like D-Dot see me, and he like, oh, cool, what you doing? I'm like, yo, I'm in here with Chucky. So then D-Dot is walking me around, meeting everybody.
You were supposed to be there. You were supposed to be
there. Yeah, D-Dot is my Howard fan. Before then, it's me, Tracy, my whole crew. We outside of a puff party, you know what I'm saying, in 93. Right. Talking about, yo, we wasn't, not, and I give you the real, because it's us talking. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I never was like, yo, Puff, get me into the party. I'm like, yo, D, we out here. Get us in.
Right.
You know what I mean? To the Puff
party. Yeah, that coming to get you. That coming to get you.
Yeah, so that's where those connections come and why Nonchalant is so key in the foundation of who I am.
So Diddy went to school with y'all at the same time in Howard?
No, Diddy only went to school for one year. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. By the time you're talking about, I came in 92. So by the time you're talking about 94, 95, I'm 2 years in. But now Puff is making the Mary J. Blige records. He's making the Jodeci records. People from our campus, Two Kings and a Cypher is on BET as Ron Lawrence and Derek Angeletti. But then it's just like now we starting to see like, oh, they running Billboard. Chucky is running Billboard. They starting to get these records at Uptown because Puff was a student but then left. You see what I'm saying? So, but yeah. the trickle down of what was happening, you got to remember, on our campus is Diggable Planets, Shy. You know, the R&B group Shy.
Yeah, Shy, for sure.
Came from Howard, you know, regular singing in the corner or whatever, got a deal. You got to remember, let's say, at that time, all of the Hitmen wasn't formed yet. But if you have a core to where it's Nasheen, Chucky, D-Dot, Ron Lawrence is all around us. Remember, Nasheen was engineering back then, right?
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, Nasheem has a lot of engineering credits on a lot of the early Bad Boy records. Nasheem was a beast as an engineer. Yeah, man. Yeah. Yeah.
That explains why T-O-N-Y sound like it sound.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But you got to remember, like, a very young, like, Raheem Devon is around.
Right.
Like all of these seeds are being planted by what's going on by the older OG. So they was taking care of us, and we was taking care of the next generation. That's basically how it happened. So as they was the party throwers. They was the, like, Puff was a party thrower. So as he moves up and he starts making records and he's in Uptown, now we take over the party throwing aspect.
Right.
You had your Mark Barnes down there who had clubs and certain things like that, like Republic Gardens. But in terms of, like, just random parties that was popping up to where, you know, you had a conglomerate of students that was bringing down all the hip-hop DJs. So ask a SNS. Ask a doo-wop. We was the ones bringing the New York City, a Kid Capri. We was bringing that down to D.C. to service our crowd.
That's... So, did Nonchalant, Chucky's integrated you into the Bad Boy family, basically.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? See your brother from school. Yeah. How do we get to Rockefeller? How we end up with Jay?
So... You got to remember, like at the same time that Chucky is my OG, he's also a really good dude.
Right.
A really, really good dude. So it got to a point, like, around 99 where I felt like I was on a plateau. Where I was like, yo, I'm making money and I can, you know what I mean? I'm doing what I'm doing, but I'm not growing. I'm just, like, when you go to the club and you be like, yeah, I could drink for free and it's the same DJ and I'm seeing the same faces for 6 months and it's just, like, this gets boring. So I was like, yo, I told Chuck, I was like, yo, I think I want to try my hand in New York because I don't feel like I'm growing enough in D.C.
Right.
So Chuck gave me his blessing. You know what I mean? He was just like, yo, if that's what you want to do, go do that, and I'm not going to hold you back. So, again, me leaving D.C. and saying I want to try my hand in New York, immediately I go to D-Dot because D's in New York.
Right.
So it's time. D-Dot was renting. Jimmy Henchman got locked up. Right?
Right. And
D-Dot was renting out Jimmy Henchman's studio, the one that's right across the street from the 4040 right now.
The little small joint.
Yes, the small joint. We was right there. It said Henchman on the floor. As soon as you got off the elevator, you walked in, it said Henchman on the floor, right? So D-Dot was like, I need an engineer. And I'm like, D, I got you. I know what I'm doing. So in 99, I go to New York and start working with D on the Mad Rapper album.
Right.
So that's where I meet my assistant, Kamel. But you got to remember, Now I'm on 25th Street between 6th and 7th, or well, actually between 5th and 6th.
Right.
That's where it's at.
It's so, that battery.
Yeah, yeah. But a block up. You know what I'm saying? Like a block up. So I go in there with D-Dot, and D-Dot's doing sort of the Mad Rapper compilation album, which means that as I'm recording this, I'm meeting the Beat Nuts, right? They on the album. I'm meeting Raekwon. Raekwon's on the album. This little white kid that we seen at the Lyricist Lounge, Doc gets him for $5,000, and later he becomes this kid named Eminem. But you gotta remember, Eminem is on Stir Crazy on the Mad Rapper album.
Right.
It's all that early time of me interacting with Busta and me interacting with like all the MCs. So now, not only are we working on the Mad Rapper album, but D-Dot is still servicing beats for all the outside people. So D-Dot did exactly what Puff did. If Puff got the Hitman, then D-Dot got a conglomerate, right? That was Blink. That was Charlamagne. Not Charlamagne the God, but Charlamagne the producer, right? That ended up doing Blueprint 2 for Jay. Coptic was in there. And this early Kanye kid was in there. So all of those people was who Dot had formed. And say if Goody Mob comes up, then Dot is looking at me as the engineer, and he's like, yo, go get me Kanye March, go get me Coptic June, go get me the, and we just have DATs of every month. Every producer was just whatever beat you made for that month, you put them on a DAT, you sent them to Dot, and Dot was selling your beats.
Right.
And then, when the artist did the record, right, which is a lot of that reason of why people want to argue about ghost producing and all this other shit and all, you know what I mean, all that dumb shit, but it's right. Like, no. This person made the beat. Dot had the connects to sell the beat. And then when they actually did the record, now Dot is bringing it back to us and being like, okay, now we got to do the drops. We got to add on whatever strings we going to do. Like, Dot was producing the records.
Basically.
Like, producing all the, but that was the connect. So I'm just telling you my story of, like, by this 1 year of me doing just the Mad Rapper album, now I done touched all these other people. So I was like, yo, I want to go independent as an engineer. And the girl that was in, I'm trying to paint this picture that back then there wasn't a lot of young black engineers. It just wasn't. We wasn't abundance like that, right? It was a big thing. The Allied Pool had a grip on New York City. So that was like Joe Quindy, Tony Maserati, like all those people that was in the Allied Pool, they was getting all the sessions.
Right.
So I went to the head, the girl that used to be the receptionist, and I was just like, yo, I got to figure out who manages this Doro nigga. Because he's the only young black nigga that I know that's like getting all these major sessions. And I was like, who the fuck manage Doro?
It's L'Oreal.
So, yes, I come across L'Oreal. So right. The girl that was the front was like, nah, I know L'Oreal, boom, boom, boom. So she hooks me up with L'Oreal. The very next day, L'Oreal had, we had a literally like a 30-minute phone conversation. I was like, L'Oreal, I know the SSL, I know the Neve, I know the API, I'm ready to work, boom, boom, boom. She understood, I could have been lying, you know what I'm saying? But she understood off faith, she was like, nah. So what L'Oreal was killing was she was the A&R administrator up at Def Jam. So she like, yo, if I'm putting all these engineers on these sessions every day, why am I not getting the percentage of that, which is fair? So it's just like, yo, I'm going to start managing them. So the day I got with L'Oreal, the very next day, she had me in a DMX session. Very next day.
Now keep in mind, she was co-managing me at the time.
No. That woman's vision is incredible.
Yeah.
So it was one day where, like, you got to remember, she had broke people off into certain things. Not just that, but it was just naturally the way it happened, right? So, of course, Doro is not only engineering major sessions, but he's also building his thing with Clue, right? So Doro's going to be over there building Fab, building Paul Kane, building Joe Buttons, building, like, all the MCs that came through Desert Storm. That was his company with Clue. So he's doing all that, right? So then Pat was sort of, like, over there with Murder, Inc. and was doing, like, all of that. You know what I mean? Like, all of those sort of things. So
Pat was with 50.
Yeah, Pat, but he also did a lot of Pharrell shit. He did, you know what I'm saying? But then she moved Pat to when it was like, okay, so now Pat is over here doing all this Pharrell shit and doing, like, we was rotating different people, right? So then Brian went over there and started fucking with them and, like all of the things that they was doing, was the biggest like conglomerate of like now young black engineers is controlling the actual black music that's coming out. So it was one specific day where Pat couldn't do this Bleak session. And Pat was like, yo, Goo, can you go over there and cover for me? So then I go over there and I do this Bleak session. Me and Bleak just like, you know what I mean? Pause, we fall in love with each other. Like, that's my nigga. Like, right. I love Bleak. Like, that's my guy. You know what I mean? Like, to this day, that's my guy.
Right.
And it wasn't no, like, underhanded cutthroat thing. It was like, we all had major camps that we was trying to hold down. So he was like, yo, Goo, go ahead and do that. If you and Bleak is clicking, keep, because I'm over here. And I'm doing this. I can't take all of this. And L'Oreal is organizing all of this. You understand what I'm saying? So that was the first day where it was like me and Bleak kind of connected. And then Jay came over and seen me and Bleak working and basically was like, yo, I like the way you work. Like, throw up my reel. And then me and Jay started working. So then that's when you was already at Baseline, right? Before, and for people to be clear, I don't think they really understand when you say these stories of like, yo, I was working on these records, the Smoker record, and this record, and this the other records. The walls wasn't even finished yet at Baseline. Like, it wasn't even done being built. No,
to even go further back, Malik Sealy walked Jay Brown and I through Baseline when it still had the plastic and everything on it. Like, neither one of the rooms were ready yet. Right. So, you know, when you get a restaurant and you put your first dollar on the wall,
right.
I had the first PO from Electrical, a 30-day PO. That was my PO on the wall. So I remember when the Avon got finished, y'all just took it over from there.
So what happened was Jay had another engineer at that point that was working with him, Chauncey, right? So
me and Can't forget Chauncey. That was a movie. That was a movie.
A whole movie. If you remember in the beginning, I'm working with Bleak, and then they come to us with this idea of like, yo, we're going to focus everything at this one studio. You know, Malik Sealy and Wanda made this space, boom, boom, boom. So me and Bleak used to be jumping around doing a normal thing that every other artist do, right? One day we in Hit Factory, one day we in Quad, one day we in, you know, like I was working with Bleak consistently now. So they told us like, yo, we're going to go to this place called Baseline on 26th between 6th and 7th. And then that's when I first came into Baseline. And like Jay had invited me to be like, yo, come down here. So once I think Hop has seen me work, Hop was like, yo, we need homeboy to be like in here. And that's when I started the consistent Baseline work. But it really came through Bleak of us finishing the understanding at that point. And then when we come in there and we finished the understanding, then that's when the Dynasty work started coming in. Because if you remember, Chauncey had like the first half of the Dynasty. And then I had like the second half.
Yeah, so like after he pulled that move, it was a wrap.
Yeah, it was a wrap. It was a wrap. he wrote a note to Doro, and it was like he was threatening him. Like he wrote a note on the track sheet. You know what I mean? Like, and it was just like I didn't know none of this was going on. You know what I mean? I'm coming in fresh and you know what I mean? Like without knowing none of this information, I'm just the kid that's like everybody's like, yo, let's get this kid to work here, and I'm just like, yeah, let's go. Like, it is what it is. I came in from that angle. That's how I got into Baseline, was from working with Bleak on the Understand the album.
And the crazy thing is when y'all finally got in the A-Room, that's kind of put more glue for me to get J2. So I was in the B-Room working on Mocha.
Right.
I'm electric.
Right.
And I was doing the You, Me, Him, and Her beat at the time. Okay. So you know how small the B room was.
Yeah.
I didn't even know Jay was in the room.
Back then, we used to have the blue, before we put the digital board in there, it was the blue Soundcraft board that was
exactly.
And that I got that board. That board sounds so chunky and so warm. I still got that board, Bink. I still got it.
Yeah, you're a hell of a guy for having that in your stand. I used to love that B room. I ain't gonna lie.
Oh, I'll give you real facts. OG Juan had it in storage and he was trying to get rid of it. So OG Juan did me the favor. That's a $20,000 board. He sold it to me for like 5 G's. He was like, good. But he was just awesome. I need to get this shit out of storage.
Yeah. I paid 5 G's in storage. Yeah.
He was like, cool, just give me like 5 G's for it. And I'm like, for the Soundcraft? I was like, yeah, I got you. Yeah.
And that's when I had Doug with me.
Yeah.
Doug Wilson. So when he came, he heard the beat. I just seen him rapping to himself. I turned around, I stopped the beat, like, no, don't stop it. I press play again, and he,
let me give you another story. I never gave this story before, right? Doug Wilson is the person who made me read the entire SSL manual. And I tell you the story of why. What DDOT was and his genius of not only having a company, but teaching us, right? So we used to get upset because we thought DOT was trying to sun us. So we'd be at Crazy Cat and DOT would be like, all right, everybody, we all going over to Bad Boy, right? I got a mix. So imagine in theory, DOT is the producer and he could just go there with the engineer and do the mix. He's bringing his whole company so that you can see how this is done and get this experience, right?
That part.
He's looking at it like, oh, you trying to tell us to work like Bad Boy? You trying to say, no, but this is dumb us. This is 22, 23-year-old us, right? But I never forget it. It's me and God rest his soul, Ebo, was doing the session for Dot, and we was mixing something in there. And Dot had a session where he had did the fader like levels on one session. And if people remember the SSL, you would save a different session, but he had the drops that he liked on a different session in the SSL. So right. He was trying to combine these two sessions to be like, yo, I want the faders from this one and the drops from this one. And I didn't know how to do it.
Right.
So Doc gave us a couple minutes, me and Ebo sitting there, we reading the manual. He's like, gets upset with us and is like, yo, walk to him in the other room. And Doug Wilson was working on something. And literally like this, my nigga, no lie. Doug Wilson walks in the room and Dot tells him what he wants. And Doug Wilson walks over to the thing and goes and walks out the room. And I was like, never again. I'm never getting caught out there where I don't know like what it is. And it was literally like, you know, combined mix from here to here. And I swear to God, he didn't even look at the screen. He just was typing. You remember you had to type the commands back in on
the SSL. The green so, writing.
Bro, it was less than 5 seconds where he just typed it in real quick and didn't even look at Dot to be like, is that what you want? He just walked out. And I was like, never again. And I read the whole manual that next week. Doug Wilson made me read the whole manual.
He was, and the crazy thing is, I never really totally understood how much you had to know to run this. Because that whole board just a big one big mind fuck when you think about it. Yeah. Because remember, we were slaving the 2-inch with the Pro Tools.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So we were running both of them together.
Yeah.
So that's a lot going on when you think about it.
But it was also times even before the Pro Tools where, like say, Chucky would have a faith session and the music is so much and I didn't get a chance to like really do a 2-track of it. But then I got vocals on a second reel to where it was one session where we brought in a third reel. And I had to go in and rewind like maybe 30 seconds before the punching point for Faye. And we had 3 reels all together, locked all together. And I would have to rewind like 30 seconds to give it enough time for all 3 reels to lock into each other.
Which is about $600, ladies and gentlemen. It's about 2-something, almost 3-something per reel. Let's talk about that.
So once Pro Tools came and it's like, yo, okay, we can just keep going. That was the perfect thing. That was the perfect thing. Yeah.
When did you realize though that Jay was gonna be like iconic, like this? I'm a part of some iconic shit right now. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think like I want to say Blueprint Time. Blueprint Time was like we moving out of, you know, there's levels to this, right? Like you a rapper, you know, but then you have some hits. Okay, you got some hits, but then like now you get to this status of like, say where he was at around Volume 2 where he comes with the Annie record and it's like, okay, now you project it into pop culture to where all throughout the 90s we was understanding hip hop is becoming pop.
Right.
Like this is the biggest music out there. So then, to go beyond, like, I got a couple of those, but to be able to make the Blueprint at that point in his career, to be able to change the sound. You got to remember, I don't think people really understand of how much of a change of the sound Dynasty and Blueprint was because, and not to discredit Swiss. Swiss was doing what he's doing, but it's the fact that everybody else was copying Swiss. You understand what I'm saying? So Swiss is making a fresh sound, but it's like the Triton and the Trinity become the go-to thing for anybody that want to make a hip hop beat, they trying to sound like Swiss. So that sound became oversaturated and that's what we're dealing with at that given moment. So to move it all the way back to where motherfuckers is like, nah, we gonna go back to this core essence, but bring all this extra shit into it, and we'll become that big. The blueprint was when I was like, yo, this is different. This is now, you said the word, you said the word iconic. And that's where I was like, yo, now this now becomes on one of them levels of the blueprint is on that level of Back in Black for AC/DC. It's on that level of Bob Marley. It's on that level of, you know, when you want to talk about the Beatles, when you want to talk like Michael Jackson, those albums that strike gold at that moment that you can't reproduce, that's what the blueprint is.
Because the anticipation for that album was overwhelming.
Overwhelming.
Like, because I remember a version leaked out, like just a bootleg version with all different orders of the songs, all types of shit. And people was calling like, yo, which one of y'all? But I don't know.
Right, we didn't know at that given time. We wasn't done.
But it was just dope for me to see who handwriting was that on that note sheet. That was your handwriting, right?
That was the crazy part. And Bink, this is what hurts my heart all the time. The crazy part is that the names of the records is my handwriting, and the producers and the comments is Kamel handwriting. So it was like, that was the list that we were starting to put together and go off of. But then Kamel would start writing down certain things, you know, and I say Kamel because Kamel is my assistant that has passed, right? And just his influence on what we was doing. But that was my handwriting of just a basic like, okay, let's get organized. We in here, it's like me and Hip Hop sitting in there, and we got records, and what are we doing? And I start writing the records down, and then Kamel started writing the producers, and then we was like, okay, well, you can see where it was a couple bonus tracks, and then we scratched those off, and then we fixed those with other records. But that was the beginning of just the organizational thought of, okay, well, where are we at? Because it was so quick. That shit was so, you know, the making of that record was so quick. And then when you came in, it was like, oh shit, like we got something. But that was, think about it. Your three records come off of one time of you driving up, parking, paying for a park, and that one parking ticket or whatever you did, you know what I mean, parking your car, you sold three records.
Came in with five. The other two went to the state property. But matter of fact, I came the night when the room was filled. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
Y'all had everybody there. Like he had played like maybe like five or six records, like Girls, 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 Song Cry, like Take Over. Like he played. I mean, he played all the great joints on the album, and then turned around to me and was like, listen, you know you were supposed to be in here. Because remember, you're supposed to play in the front room first.
Right.
He was like, yo, you know you were supposed to be in here. Like, don't make an ass out of me. I was like, bro, I got you. Right. And it was just, but the pressure, like, it was some real pressure because, like I said, the vibe was already great.
Nah, you delivered. And to deliver with the intro, to have it to where it's like, yo, all right, we're going to start with this and we're going to end with this.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Like, that's a open big thing. It was like the bookends. It was almost like, okay, now I got the perfect bookends for the subject matter of what I'm doing. You know what I mean? Like, and that was my very first time where Jay looked at me for Takeover and was like, yo, can you mix this? And that was I've been recording them, you know what I'm saying? End the Dynasty.
Yeah.
And then we hit the stride with Blueprint in terms of recording. And me and him have figured out a nice flow in terms of recording, but then that Takeover was the first time where he was like, yo, I'm gonna do this at Summer Jam, and I'm gonna do it. And he was like, looked at me for the mix. And I was just like, oh shit, I'm about to mix a Jay-Z record now. So Takeover was my first like Jay-Z mix.
Right.
And that was a big thing. You know what I mean? So I was like, oh, homie, trust me to like with the final of it. So that was a huge thing. And then them other beats you gave us ended up, it wasn't like, oh, these other beats, we're not using them. It was just like, yo, these three is pertinent. Yo, can we get them other two for our other like, we also working on this and this and this. Can we get them for this? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, that was
that was a great feeling. That was a great feeling for me.
I wanted to also ask you, too, what was the thing about, like, you sampling your own drum kit, right? In terms of, like, what was your process in terms of sampling? Because for people that don't know, and for people that may not be me and have been to your crib when you was living in Jersey, and I've been to your crib in multiple places, right? But
yeah.
you, the thing of you, like, sampling yourself and then putting that into the 3000 and like making that rap?
I mean, to be totally honest with you, bro, I was snatching live snares from jazz records. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So right. I was basically doing the same thing that people were doing for breakbeats, but I was literally so meticulous about finding that right pop. But the way I programmed it made it sound like I played the drums, sampled it, and then put it in the MP. Mm, okay. You see what I'm saying? Because back then, dudes used a lot of dirty hi-hats and shit, where I didn't. Because I was on the Triton early too. Well, TR rack anyway. It was called TR rack for the rack mount.
Yes,
absolutely. So basically all my percussion and shit came from that. Like people, so many people sampled that Congo at the beginning of All I Need, and they came right out of the TR rack. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was just crazy. And the hi-hats, everything, you know what I'm saying, came out of there. So it was just like, that's what made me different from everybody else is the fact that I approached it as a drummer.
Right.
My programming. So it made everybody think I was playing live. The only record I played live on, literally, was When They Remember for Freeway.
Right. Okay.
That's the only record I actually played live on. You know what I'm saying?
But it's a thing, Bink, where I guess as a fan, I'm trying to express this the right way, right? Where I've had drummers that are like, and they all have their different styles, right? So say like Tony Royster, when he plays for Jay, he's a very like church drummer. He's hitting all the fills in between every, you know, half of it that could possibly go. Or we could go all the way to like Quest, to where he's like the ultimate breakbeat. He's just like playing the break over and over. So it's you have this mixture where it feels church. It's also on time, you know what I mean? The way that Quest drums, but it's like, where's that combination? Where did you settle on this is what, because you don't overfill it, you know? Like, and sometimes with my church drummers, it's so much feeling of the blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yo, you're complicating the shit too much.
And you know, you're doing too much. But this goes back, it goes back to my mom.
Okay.
It goes right back to my mom. Cause like I say, my mom was a choir director. She would look back at me like, yo, calm down. Mm. So it gave me a discipline of only using fills as transition. Basically, I'm telling you, okay, we're going from the verse to the hook now.
Right.
Okay, we're coming back from the hook to the verse now.
Right.
Because any musician will tell you they would rather have a pocket drummer than a nigga to do tricks any day.
Me personally, as a DJ, I want to scratch to a pocket drummer.
Right. People who do all this, they playing for themselves.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? for another drummer. Whereas I just combined the two, and me and Chucky did a record for Chuck Brown on his birthday.
Yeah.
Called
yeah.
Love Nationwide. Yes, and I asked Chuck Brown about that, and he was like, "Yo, I just want my drummer to stay in the pocket, and then give me a chopped barbecue." And I was
right.
I was like, chopped barbecue, like, what's that? Right. He was like, chopped barbecue. I was like, oh, crazy. Yeah. You know what I mean? So that's how I always looked at my music. Like, that never doing too much to disturb the pocket.
Right.
Only giving you transition when it's time to, when we're actually making the transition to somewhere so you can feel that we're moving somewhere and coming back from somewhere.
But then how do you incorporate because it's hard to define, because you have certain samples that are where you're letting the sample breathe on certain records.
Mm-hmm.
You have certain ones where you're doing the, like, I'm chopping just the and you make a new thing out of that you know what I mean? So there's certain records where, like I said, like you'll fall across this record and people that are so intricate into samples, they want to do the and you, like, as the producer, is like, no, bro, let this sample breathe for this half a bar, and, you know, that's the magic of it, but you also have the ones. So how do you determine when it's time to do those sort of things? Because I think the Bink style, right, with the thing that has been gone, you know, the thing that goes down in history is, like, this is the Bink style, right?
Right.
It's a combination of those two things. So it's really hard to define in terms of, like, if I was to define Primo, I'd be like, yo, Primo takes these little ill chops and makes new things out of it. Whereas a Pete Rock takes five different records and can have them all in key, but they're one bar loops and, you know, horn stabs and these.
Right.
Things. So it's like, where's the combination? And then if you put that into your style, it's like, what would you yourself say defines your style?
I mean, for real, and it's ill that you named Primo, because that's who I learned it from. I learned it from Primo and Dilla, because they always took smaller increments of the sample. Right. Whereas I learned that when you take, like, for instance, Donuts, you know, the song will start off at its regular speed, and then he'll speed it up at the same pitch. I'm like, how is he doing this?
Right.
So he's literally, like, taking pieces and putting it back together.
Right.
So I started calling that my Gordon Gottrell. You know what I'm saying? Like from the Cosby Show type thing. You know what I'm saying?
Like, sure, I pieced all together, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what you, me, him, and her was.
Okay.
Think about it. You know what I'm saying? Like, most people didn't even know that was the Moments for years.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But I sampled it on 45 and then did like another plus 20 on it after that. You know what I'm saying? But remember the snare. Like just that turnaround every time. So it was like, it's a case by case situation. Whereas 1-900 Hustler is drawn out. Boop, 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 boop.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
the whole, that's my point. That's a great example. To where as I don't understand if people understand where like 1-900 Hustler is drawn out, but it's also a thing of, if you go back to the record you were talking about before, it's a like, so it's a chop, but then it's just like, okay, the turnaround is going to be the, but we coming back to that same. So it's these two completely different approaches, I guess I would say.
Right. Well, to me, you, me, him, and her reminds me of the intro to Eric B for President, the extended version. Which Salon Remy ended up coming back and doing for Mack Wilds.
Right.
So it always feels like the record is starting over. You know what I'm saying?
When you say always it that way, starts. I get it.
You feel me? So it's like that section of Eric B for President, the extended version, you can rock to that alone without even letting the beat play.
That's what the DJs, call a go to the bathroom record, where you can just let that shit rock. Right. Run to the bathroom real quick.
Or the Frankie Beverly extended version before I let it go.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Right. So that's another thing Chuck Brown told me. He was like, yo, I said, how did you come up with Go-Go? He was like, well, I noticed that people jam more on the breakdown.
Right.
He said, so I came up with one long breakdown. That's some genius shit, that, you know what I mean?
Right.
To think of. Right. So he basically do one long ass breakdown and just put melody to it. You know what I'm saying? So my shit was, you know, I'm from Virginia, we're like a melting pot, you know, really military driven. So we had go-go, we had reggae, right. We got Midwest, we got DJ Magic Mike, you know what I'm saying? All this stuff I'm listening to.
Right.
So came down to do music, I'm already seasoned with all of this shit.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? I'm already ready to go in whatever genre I need to go in. Right. I can do a set it off beat, Planet Rock, or something with some crazy instrumentation to it. Like, so that's why my shit is like so widespread, because Virginia is like a melting pot of music, just right. Melting pot of vibes. So that's why all producers from Virginia, drum game is different.
Yeah.
Not Pharrell, myself, Timbaland, Danger Hands, you see what I'm saying? Because we all been influenced by so many different places.
I don't know, but whatever that water is that's going to Knott's house, I need a little bit of that. Like that's
the closest thing we got to Dilla. That's the closest thing we got to Dilla right now. And the crazy thing was, Dilla used to be down here a lot with him. Like Dilla just be at Knott's studio for days.
That boy different. He's different.
He's a machine, bro. And look, and keep in mind, we used to be a crew.
I didn't know that.
Called the Teamsters. Yeah, we were a crew back in the day.
That boy different.
So imagine playing beats beside this nigga. You know what I'm saying? Like, just like the pressure was like, sometimes just like, you know what? I ain't even got my CD on me, cuz, you know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Yeah, I got my CD.
I remember like me and Knife being like, yo, we got to seek him out and ask him, does he want to be a part of the Soul Council? Because like, for me, he's just different. It's just different.
There's nobody.
He can do everything.
There's nobody fucking with Knox chop game.
Yeah.
Cause he had changed the whole time signature.
Yeah.
Something that you thought couldn't be sampled.
Right. Right.
He has rearranged the whole time. Because
it's in a 3-4 or 6-4 or yeah.
He gonna do it. He gonna make it him every time. And he picks some of the
gritty
most
and grimy and make it a pop hit with dun 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 dun.
Yeah, that's Megahertz.
That
was Megahertz. That's another good friend of mine.
Like,
I just love people who just put their own funk on their thing. You know, they put their own twist to it. Like something that you can't really, because the first time I heard Dilla was from Buster. He was at Soundtracks. Mm-hmm. He just left his door open. Just letting the dad play. And these beats were just fading into each other. Like, literally, like, just seamless. They just fade into each other, Guru. And I'm just like, who is this, bro? And it was just so many different pockets that he was doing. Back never the same drums.
Back when Buster was at Mirror Image, he was doing the Mirror Image thing. He played me the Rod Digger record, right? Early, before anybody heard it. You know, with Imperial and like all those joints on it.
Right.
And then he played me him, and I was just like, what the fuck is this? Because it's tribe but better. And nobody wanted to say that at the given time. And it's no disrespect. Right. You know, Jarobi is like my best friend. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
But it was like, try but better, right? So then B-Ha started co-managing him. You know what I mean? Basically, like I'm going to help you out in New York. Like, send me some beats. He wasn't the main manager, but he was like, help. And I hit B-Ha one day, and I was just like, yo, I don't care what the session is. I just want to get in with him because I don't believe that he's that good. Something, it got to be a homie in the basement. It got to be a something. Nobody can be that good. So then B-Ha got me a session with Dilla, and we just made beats. I forget who the artist was for because the artist never came. And it was just me and him in the studio one day. And you know me, it's back and forth. He like, Goo, can you roll up? I'm like, yeah, all right, cool. It's me, him, records, and an MPC 3000, and I watched it. And I was just like, it's him.
Machine.
It's like, him.
That guy is insane. Like, people don't understand. He started the whole push-pull.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? With the snare being a little late, kick coming.
What I noticed, Bink, was, like, the session I was doing with him, and I know people talk about so much about him, like not programming with quantizing, and that's basic for us, like, to not program with quantizing. But what I did notice was, like, when he was chopping up breaks, when he was in that phase, he would take the, like, kick hi-hat and then the snare hi-hat and then the double kick to the hi-hat and then cut it off. So it was like he was really allowing the break to breathe, which gave it a flow, but it was just like it wasn't just this like kick, snare, hi, the way we think about it, to where like
right.
I'm programming the hi-hat. He would be programming, but it would be like this pad got like the kick and other information all the way to whatever was next, all the way up into the snare, and then the snare, all the information, and even if that's a ghost kick, all the way into the next major kick, and he would program that, and I was like, yo, I never thought about it that way.
And phantom notes is everything. That's where your feel comes from.
Yeah, I never thought about
it. Those, so that's why I say most people will sample the breakbeat, but not include the phantom note.
Right.
Changes up the whole feel, makes it sound like a robot immediately, you know what I'm saying? Whereas he understood all those nuances were necessary.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And that's the type of guy that would learn from.
Watching people process and being like, okay, this is why. Because I'm always interested in why does it sound like that? And that was my thing when I got with him. I was like, oh, I get it now. You know what I mean? I get it now. Like, he was a different animal.
Stupid. But you started with Nonchalant touring, and then you end up touring with Jake. Now, that's a whole, like, Fool just had a crowd for sure.
Right.
The Jay-Z shit, you probably couldn't even hear yourself think on stage. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, real different. Shit.
It's different. I think what people need to recognize and understand, because they'll be like, you know, I get hate. I get a lot of hate where people will be like, why is Goo in that position? I'll be like, bro, it ain't just about the scratches. It's about the timing. So me and him, our connection on when I can see when he wants the record to go, when he wants me to hold it up, I can technically, you know, bring in, okay, this is what we need to do at this particular moment. I think people don't understand that whole aspect of what we do in the show. So it's enough that where like my scratches are supposed to be an instrument inside of the band. And I think a lot of DJs don't understand that standpoint because they're used to being the show by themselves.
Right.
So it's just like, yeah, it's like, bro, you get into a band situation, you are another instrument. So don't be sloppy over top of another nigga. Don't be just like trying to showcase that you the best at this particular flair. At this, no, no. Does it fit into what we doing right now? What does this song call for? Sometimes some songs call for you to step back and not do nothing. Some songs,
exactly.
Oh no. Sometimes if it's like Hovi, baby, then I'm going for my. I'm following him, the words.
Right.
But I'm doing it with an ill scratch sound. And I'm also like kicking off songs knowing that he has certain cue points and certain like motions that means go, or certain times where you gotta hold up. That's the part of it that I think DJs who may have studied how to scratch don't necessarily know how to carry the flow of a show.
And that's what Tribe showed us. Showed us that.
Yes.
Because scratches are transitions. It takes you to the next beat, you know what I'm saying? So you're just getting in where you fit in. So like you said, some dudes just want to transform and just do them, trying to shine. It's like, bro, it's not about shining. It's about fitting in to what's going on. Know what I mean?
You'll get your time for that. If you want to put in a five-minute segment of, yo, let me cut up this record and let me showcase how nasty I am. Yeah, but understand that everybody could do that. The drummer for the whole show could be like, I'm the best drummer in the world. And that's not what we're asking you to do. We're asking you to play this beat. The bass player could be like, I'm the best bass player in the world. And that's not what we asking you to do. We asking you to play this beat. The keyboard player could be like, I'm going to run these. No, that's not hip hop, bro. Hip hop is a lock into this thing. And we keep coming back to this thing so that the MC, so understanding yourself from a turntablist standpoint, but a turntablist in a band. In a band. You gotta realize that us, we looking at it like, okay, Jay-Z's not Busta Rhymes. Jay-Z's not going to give you all this animated movement and all this other shit. So the music and the visuals and everything that go along with the show is the animated part. So he could be his smooth Rakim self. You understand what I'm saying? So that's where understanding who the artist is, but also understanding like what your point is. And I've also sat with him to be like, we're going to transition from this one song into this one song into this one. And it makes sense in terms of building a show. So that's the big difference, is understanding that this is a show on a huge scale, and people not understanding that pressure of, you know, you might fall from the pressure of 20,000 inside of the Garden. I'm talking about 70, 80,000 inside of a soccer stadium.
That part. Jay always had a seamless show, though. Always.
I'm gonna give you the realest shit. When we was coming back with 444, and we had the Jeff Koons balloon thing in the back of us, right? And we went over to Europe first, and we did those shows. We had a show where the Pro Tools power went out.
Wow.
So everything that I'm triggering, because I use the APC 40, you know what I'm saying, to trigger all the songs, and I'm scratching through Serato. Something told me. And I don't know if you, whatever you want to call it, the universe, God, you know, whatever your spiritual, you know what I mean, denomination.
Right.
I'm not here for that. Something told me, yo, Goo, take all the TV tracks and put them shits in your Serato. So while we in the show, he gets to the second song and the power goes out to the Pro Tools, which means that we have no more backing tracks. I'm really supposed to be just adding the scratching sounds and kicking off the songs. My APC 40 is connected to that Pro Tools, to where I start the songs.
Right.
It goes out. Omar looks at me and he's like, yo, the power went out. I'm like, oh, this is all in a 5-second thing. I looked at my Serato, I looked at Omar, and I said, yo, I got it. Otherwise, Jay would have been out there telling jokes. There's no more music. So now I switch from being, you know, turntablist in terms of I'm about to show you how I can scratch this thing the illest, to I got to hold down this show from my turntables. So
right.
I go to my list that got all the TV tracks and I start running the show from the turntables, old school style, like we That's what I'm saying. DJs got to understand. That's the responsibility. That's when you got to like completely like, you know me, I got my drink on. I got my smoke on. I'm high. I completely sober up to be like,
you had to
run the whole show right now from my turntable.
Right. You had to. Because right now had it's to. Like, you are the show right now.
Had to. So that's the thing of why Goo is in that position. You know what I'm saying? Or somebody that knows the music. Or somebody that says, yo, we need this version. So I don't got to call nobody. I'm pulling out my drives and I'm making that version because I got all the sessions. To somebody who's like, yo, no, I don't need to fly with Hov on a private jet. Why? Because I need to be on the bus with the band just in case we got to change this and that. I need to make sure everybody's in sync so that by the time this man walk on stage, all he got to worry about is saying his raps. That's it.
That part. So the way you approach the show is the way I approach doing the drops in the record.
Yeah.
Because people don't understand drops in the record. It adds character. It's everything.
Makes the whole record.
Makes the whole record. So that's what my Blueprint records really shined at. Just dropping it in the right spots. You know what I'm saying? And just letting his verse make more sense in certain spots.
Right.
Because I remember he asked me though to drop it on the kitchen table as well. You know what I'm saying? Like,
But you could do a drop, but you as the producer say, if I'm going to do a drop, then you know what? Now that this record is done, I'm going to go back and I'm going to record myself going like the hand motion that you did on an actual table and recording that, people got to understand you put that into the record after the idea came of Kitchen Table.
And that was,
like
that was the organ stool.
Oh, the organ. Yeah.
I was being on the organ stool and sound on sound. You know what I'm saying? I wouldn't take this. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. That, for real, in high school, people wouldn't freestyle without me beating on the table.
Right. Right.
They would literally say, go find Bink.
Right.
So my pencil was the hi-hat.
I'm just trying to make that distinction, Bink, between the beat maker and the producer. So it's like, yeah, you made the beat, and then he did the raps, and then now I'm producing the record. Now I'm making it the best record that it could be and adding all these little things that y'all love. This is the difference between a beat maker and a producer.
And that's where I clash at with the new dudes, because I'm like, bro, send me the record.
You be too hard on the new dudes, man. You be too hard.
I'm like, yo, send me the record so I could turn this into a record. Like, what you got from me was the skeleton.
Right.
So let me get the record and let me do the drops and add keys. And like, yo, the record is, what you mean? The record's done. Like, the record is not done, bro. I said, had you heard Blueprint before I finished Blueprint?
Right.
You wouldn't be saying this.
It's a different record.
You know
record.
What I'm saying? It's a whole other record. You know what I'm saying? So that's the problem now with the young guys. That's what makes it hard for them to get classic records. And when I finally found out that Roddy Ricch, Boardy and Rance, I said, that's why he got the kind of album.
Oh, yeah, that's why he got the number one album right now. It's
that's why he got the album he got.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Can we edit this, Bink? Can I go to the bathroom real quick?
Yeah, sure. We can pick back up. So, who is it from the new school that you would actually lock in with right now, you think?
Oh, man. It's so many of them. I would love to see, like, so I got my people that I really fuck with, but I would love to see, like, me and a Polo G. Because my son put me up on like, all the young people. You know what I'm saying?
What's his name?
Polo G. He played on the Roots Picnic yesterday, along with him and G Herbo. So I've already locked in with G Herbo, you know what I'm saying, through Mickey Fats. Right. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
And people in Chicago and like all the people out there, I've locked in with G Herbo, done some mixes for him, the whole nine, you know what I'm saying? Shout out to Mickey Halstead, you know what I'm saying, too, like all my people out there. But I would love to mess with like some of the young boys. Yeah. And for me, that's more or less of like, this exact same thing you're saying of like, they got it, but then like, if we could bring a little bit of our experience in it, but still the thing be young, I think that's where the future of what we do and where it's going. Because me in my age now, I want to make sure that the youngins have a little bit of that, of the experience that we had of making albums, because they so single driven because of streaming and because of things like that. Like, so for me, you know, that's where I would like to see it. But of course, like everybody that we always been messing with, I really want to tap in with like people outside of our thing. Like I would love to see you with a Brittany Howard or something like that. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Like, if you and Brittany Howard was to sit down and she was to take, like, what she did with Alabama Shakes and this new album that she did, but to be able to do it over, like, your production and, like, your ideas and, like, you know, they come from that tradition of what we come from, but then to lock into our patterns, I think would be ill for her.
Definitely that, because I've been wanting to spread my wings more so in the singing, because I like the singing records more myself. You know what I'm saying? There's not a lot of rappers that really inspire me. You know what I'm saying? But singing wise, a lot of people I would love to lock in with.
I also want to see you, and this is just me being selfish and personal. I also want to see you and Black Thought do one of those streams of thought. So if you don't know what Black Thought's doing, he's doing these streams of consciousness albums, right? Where he locked in with Ninth and he did an album. He locked in with Sean C and LV, he did an album. He locked in with who else he did one with? This is about to be the third installment. But I would love to see you and him lock in and do.
No, listen. I hope he listened to this, because we were supposed to. We had talked about it. We was finna do it, and then he went left.
Just do it.
So I said, "Yo, I've been on him ever since." You know what I'm saying? Like, yo, we gotta do it, because like. He's like one of my favorite MCs ever, and I know what I'll do with him. You know what I'm saying? I know it. Yeah. So I'm waiting on him, basically.
Now, he's basically one of my favorite MCs of all time. And this is something I argue in rooms with Hov and, you know, a bunch of other people. But, like, I think, like, right now, where the roots is at and what they mean culturally and what Black Thought's always been on, I would love to see you do. And it's dope because he's doing, like, quick EPs where it's like 7 records. So you try to tell me that Bink and Black Thought can't get together and do 7 records? Like, that, yo, that would be incredible.
Listen, The Roots did a show in Virginia. To this day, best intro I've ever seen in a rap concert. They came in from behind the crowd on a bullhorn. No music coming through the speakers at all.
Right.
And each one of them had a percussion instrument.
Right.
Cowbell, shaker, and he's rapping on the bullhorn coming through the crowd. And when they got on stage, it was just like, you know what I'm saying? I was just like, yo.
Right.
Never in my career have I seen somebody do that type of thing right there. It was just so, he's underrated.
It's just wide open, man, as to what we could do right now in terms of, like, you know, because of the corona, because of where we at right now with streaming, because of the ease of us being able to make records and, you know, that sort of thing. I just think it's a great time for us to just continue to put out music. You finding, you know, whether or not there's MCs in Virginia, whether or not there's MCs across the world, I don't want to restrict you solely to Virginia. I don't care if you find them in Tanzania, you know what I'm saying? In Africa, or whatever. Like, you know what I'm saying? Wherever it is across the world, like, you being able to put out musical content and be like, this is me presenting artists that I really feel that's a thing that goes against whatever the, you know, the radio promotion of whatever 6ix9ine is doing at the given moment. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, I like Storms.
Yeah.
I like him too. So I'll be interested in locking in with him one day. You know, so I seen Jay took a liking to him as well.
No, that's my dude. That's my dude. If you ever need to connect, that's my dude. No, I would love to see you with a lot of UK MCs too, just to see the drum patterns of what they do, because it's based on the Almond Break, you know what I'm saying? Of what that did in creating jungle, creating grime, creating that whole genre. But then the rhythm of what that created, what you could do would be interesting in terms of musically. Like, we know the pattern, the drum pattern, but then musically, where can we go?
Right. I would absolutely love to challenge myself to do that.
You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
That would be great. Who you messing with?
I like both babies, Lil Baby and Da Baby. I like Roddy Ricch. I like Rob Wave.
Yes, yeah.
I like him. I definitely want to lock in with him too. Her, my favorite. That's my favorite R&B artist right now, period. She give me chills. SZA.
Right, right.
You know what I'm saying?
Shout out to the whole TDE. I would like, you know, as much as Kendrick is like, you know, the star and the rhymes obviously, you know, put him on that level. Mm-hmm. I would love to see you lock in with two of them, right? Which is Absol, number one. I feel like Absol is underrated as an MC. He's just like, to me, I don't know. To me, he's just at that level, but I don't think he's been recognized yet, right? And then you and J-Rock. I think you and J-Rock would be ill in terms of like what you could give him in terms of that real, just street West Coast. You know what I mean? He's that all thing.
I like Sir too.
Yeah, no, not even on the R&B tip. I'm just saying.
Okay, this one's rap shit.
The whole TDE conglomerate. You know what I mean? For me, they doing it in a way that reminds me of what we was doing. You know what I'm saying? Back when the whole crew was together and everybody was in the same room.
Now, the crazy thing is, me and J-Rock was supposed to get in back when he was signing Mayweather. This is like right after Blueprint.
Right. Because if you remember, for the younger people or people that may not know, J-Rock was the focus of TDE before Kendrick.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. J-Rock was
the focus. Yeah.
Dope. Like, he can go. You know what I'm saying? But I remember I spoke on the panel at the Impact Convention in Orlando.
Okay.
And Mayweather was there, and he sent a security at me about J-Rock. Mm. You know what I'm saying? So, but we just never got into it. But I would love to get with J-Rock. He can go.
Nah, super dope.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Yeah, man.
But, hey, man, like I said, this was like an honor. You know what I mean? To finally get you up here, you know what I'm saying? We had a big hiatus, you know what I'm saying, our relationship, you know what I'm saying, which I'm glad we back where we need to be, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, because
I think that's the main lesson, Bink, for people, you know what I mean, as grown men, to see us, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Us together and to be like, yo, like, whatever bullshit we was going through, because it was like, I say it from my end, and I'm glad you addressed it, because I'm like, I say it from my end, well, I felt like everything I always did was like trying to still bring you into whatever we was doing.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. It was like me, I took a certain thing to where I was like, okay, if you don't want to come to Baseline no more, because I remember I called you on a couple joints, right? I used to be mm-hmm. a dude that was like, it was certain producers I would call, right? And I'd be like, yo, if Jay starting the album, I'll call you and I'll call Swiss. I know Jay gonna call Pharrell. I know Jay gonna call Timbaland, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. then it got to a point where you was like, go, I'm not coming up the Baseline no more. Right? And it was like, and I said, okay, well, I'm gonna start bringing the artists to your house. So I would bring Bleak to your house, you know, I would bring those artists to your house. And then it was like almost like where we had a falling out, but it was over. Me and you never had no problems. You know what I'm saying? Ever. It was like, it was one of those things where I think that's a grown man move, and I applaud you for that, for reaching out and just for like being the grown man, you know what I'm saying? To a point where it was just like, yo, I gotta be the grown man and be like, yo, my nigga, it's never no problems. And especially in the time of days that we in right now, we gotta show that solidarity for us, not only in the music business, but just for us as black men, period.
You know, it was always me, you, hip hop, Biggs.
Right, right.
Those were the creatives in that circle to me. You know what I'm saying? That's all the only people I ever dealt with when it came to picking samples, picking songs, listening to beats, you know what I'm saying? Like those, your guys' opinion was the only opinion that really mattered to me, you know what I'm saying, in that circle. So it was just great to get back, like I said, get back in pocket with you, my guy, you know what I'm saying? I love you like a brother.
Yes, sir.
And did a lot of shit together, man. But like I said, I appreciate you coming on, Bink, about it. Yeah. And should be out, in, you know, not too long. Shouldn't be out. I mean, it should be out soon, but this was a great podcast, to be honest. Just to talk shop, it's a great podcast.
I love what you're doing too, man, because you can give it an angle that people can't really get from actually being in the trenches. It's like those that can do and those that can't teach. You know what I mean? But this is the opportunity for people to see the people that can do to actually teach. So that's a special thing of somebody that's actually in the trenches. You could learn it from somebody that talked about it or a sportscaster that was always on the sideline, but it's different when you get the actual report of how to play the game from somebody that was in the game. So I applaud you for that. And I think in time, you're going to see how many of our young children look up to you how many people need game from you, how many people, you know, like need to follow the blueprint that you set. You know, not to use a pun on words, but
yeah,
you know, we got children out here and we got people that really want that game and want to understand that from you. And I think that's your lane, brother. I think you educating our youth, you showing them, you know what I mean, keys to production, keys to the game, keys to your longevity, you know, keys to be able to say, yo, I went from Rump Shaker to Santorini, Greece, and look at everything in between. And, you know, those sort of things, I think is a great lesson for our children to learn.
Yeah, and I think the most lesson I'm trying to teach the young people is not to be afraid of being themselves.
Yes, sir.
And that's, to me, that's like the biggest thing, because everybody, this generation is just so comfortable with mimicking anything.
Right.
But not even giving their own ears a chance to shine. Like, dude, if you think it sounds good to you, that's all that matters. Right. You know what I'm saying? You may sound different from everybody else, but somebody's going to get it. So I remember how I sounded different from everybody. You know what I'm saying? I didn't get the same response I got at home till I came to New York. Right. When I came to New York, they was like, yo, what's this? I'm like, y'all like that? They're like, bro, like, yo, go bring somebody in the room. Let's just play that Chris play again. I'm like, yo, it just made you feel so good to be different. And that's all I'm trying to get them to experience. Like, I'm not here to help you sound like me. I'm here to make you be a better you. Right. You know what I'm saying? So, you know what I'm saying? You can have a tight beat named after you in a couple of years. You know what I'm saying? Rather than you mimicking a tight beat. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, that's all I'm trying to instill in them, because that's what the OG would have instilled in us.
Absolutely.
Back in the day. You know, if I came to pick you up and you came upstairs with the same jacket I had on, about your whole life.
One of us got changed.
One of us got changed. You know what I'm saying? But I'll be in L.A., man, the 14th.
Come through, man. Yeah, man. Come chop it up. Hey, Lance, everybody, like, come to the studio. Man, let's make some shit, man. For real.
Appreciate you, Guru, man.
Absolutely. Love you, brother.
Love you, too, man.